Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Shanti Shanti, dein Podcast rund um die Themen Yoga, Spiritualität, weibliche Prinzip. Mein Name ist Melanie Stalder und mir heute vis-à-vis Steven Thomas. Und mit ihm werde ich heute ganz viel über Yoga reden. Er ist nämlich schon sehr lange in diesem Feld tätig, über 25 Jahre, hat ein riesen Wissen, einen riesen Erfahrungsschatz. Und wir werden heute ein bisschen tauchen im Sinn von, was ihn beschäftigt und wie er den Blick aufs Yoga hat. Gefällt dir der Podcast? Bitte lass mir 5 Sterne da, damit ihn auch andere Leute finden. Du kannst ihm folgen, dass du immer die neuesten Episoden auch gerade kriegst. Und die Episode heute, die wird auf Englisch sein. Ist jetzt nicht meine Muttersprache, aber im Steven seine. Und es ist uns einfach ringer gegangen damit. Viel Vergnügen, viel Inspiration und danke dir fürs Zuhören. Nice to see you and hear you, Steven, that you are in my podcast, Shanti Shanti.
Thanks, Melanie. Good to be here.
So I did the 200 and the 300 teacher training with you, so you were conducting it. I think it's over 10 years now. And yeah, so I wanted to ask you a little bit about your life and about yoga. And over the past 25 years of teaching yoga, what major shifts have you noticed in the way yoga is practiced? And how have that influenced your personal approach?
Yeah, it's a big question these last years for me to reflect on, because I noticed some big shifts, especially in the past 5 or 6 years, I think, since probably since the time of COVID, where things hopped online for a while and it broke a little bit the rhythm of what was happening in the way that yoga was being offered to the community. And then overall, I would say that I see it in some ways that it is almost exactly the same in some ways. I still see a variety of people offering good work, some young teachers, some very senior teachers, and all of it seems valuable. There's a lot of sincerity in it. Students come to yoga for the same reasons that I saw 25 years ago and have seen all through my career. And so in some sense, it's still the same, and that's nice. That's refreshing, and or not refreshing, but it's comforting. It's comforting, and to know that the work still touches people for the same reasons, people still come to it for the same reasons, and that people are attracted to offering it because they were touched by the practice themselves and they want to share it. But the biggest shift I see is how it's being offered. And maybe the obvious place to start is just to see that it's much, there's a lot of noise in the marketplace because we now market our work so much through these online channels. And without being too cliche, I think the effect that social media has had on teachers has not been so positive. A lot of teachers, I think they feel a lot of pressure to remain present and constantly present in these sort of channels, which, for lack of a better word, are just pure marketing. You're just trying to jump up and down and get noticed, because you have the feeling somehow that if you don't do that, no one will find you. And people used to find you through word of mouth, or because you were in a studio and the studio was somehow a place where people would gather. And so this is maybe the biggest change I see, is that the yoga is in some ways being offered through many diverse channels, through people's living rooms and rooftops and online, and sometimes for free, and sometimes pay-per-view, and sometimes downloadable, and sometimes in the studio, and a lot more retreats and weekend workshops are happening. It's just so many offerings. And this is both beautiful because it gives people many avenues to touch the practice, but it also, I think, it creates a lot of waves. And it feels hard for people to swim in those waves, both as students, because there's so many choices now, and teachers perhaps have to tire themselves out trying to what they feel is to remain relevant, you know. That's the biggest change I see. The other big change I see is a kind of a natural thing which takes place, and that is that it has become so popular across such a wide spectrum that sometimes the quality of what's being offered gets very, very diluted. And it sounds a bit cliche to say it, but I think a lot of there's so many different offerings happening on such a superficial level. Whereas I think when I started, there was a few tracks, a few paths that you could go down, and you would sort of get involved in that track, and you would stay in it, and you would be in it for quite a while, so you could go quite deep with it. And there weren't a lot of choices, you know, even 25 years ago, or even 15 years ago. And so the multitude, or the amount of offerings, and the variety of offerings has increased dramatically. And I always try to be quite open-minded, you know, and not get into this sort of mood where I think, oh, it was better before. Not necessarily better before, but I see some minor crisis in that, where it's harder to just be patient and go deep, you know, because so many things are just dancing on the surface. And the last thing I would say, which I notice quite a lot, is that the practice was always intended to be something which you would offer yourself to. You would offer, as a student, you would offer yourself to the practice and make some sort of relationship to that work. And it starts to become, sometimes I feel that students are trying to consume the practice. What can I get out of it? What do I get out of this? You know, and this is a little bit against what the central philosophy of the practice is, which is, what can you offer of yourself to that? And you make some relationship to this practice, whatever it is that you're attracted to, and you stay with it for a while, and you develop some sort of connection to that, to the teachings, perhaps to the teacher, where you can trust that, and to the group of people that you're with that are going through that process as well. Because it's a process, right? You know that, right? And so sometimes I feel like that process part is missing, and it's a bit sometimes consumption. Mm-hmm. But having said all that, I'm still very inspired, and I still really see amazing work being done. Some fields have opened up which were not open when I was first starting, which are very, very useful and have a lot of value, and they're accessible now for people to step into them. So, like many of these things, there's some challenges with it, and there's some positive aspects as well.
You mentioned also with the competition and the market, and I think, many yoga teachers maybe are not so professional in that it's mm-hmm. a huge theme. Also the quality may then not be so important. And the other thing what I heard was also that, I mean, all these teacher trainings, I never really understood why there is only teacher trainings to go deeper when you want to learn more about yoga. Mm-hmm. Then you just go and do a 200-hour teacher training. And I think this is something what really, there are so many teachers now out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are so many, many aspects also that the profession as a yoga teacher is not geschützt. How do we say that?
Yeah.
And everyone can be a yoga teacher. And the other thing is just that for financially reasons, or most of the yoga studios need to do this yoga teacher trainings. So do you think also that this is a reason why this is how it is today, or how do you see that?
Yeah, I guess there's some downstream effect of what happened about 25 years ago, which was the birth of this Yoga Alliance training system, which is has been adopted across the globe. Somehow it's incredible that it just got adopted that way, and that's the way we do it. And it does have some limitations in it, and one of them is that it's very difficult to put high enough standards on that process. People can, you know, around the globe, they can pay for a training and they can go and do a training. And of course, there are some exceptionally good trainings and probably some very weak trainings. And it's hard for people to distinguish which is which. But in the end, you pay for it and you get a certificate, and then somehow you're supposed to be able to teach. And then, of course, as more you touch on a very important point, which is that from a financial perspective, it is what keeps many studios alive. But on the other side, I would say maybe it's the word teacher training, which I've struggled with for 10 years, I think, as I do this, because I always think to myself, is this a teacher training or is this an education in yoga? And mostly, I would say in the past 10 years that my feeling is that 80% of the people coming into that course, with me at least, or me and the team, or whatever I'm a part of, most of the participants are coming in because they would like an experience in yoga, a deep immersion into yoga for a year or 8 months or whatever it is. And they would like to, as a student, learn the essence of what yoga is, all of the limbs of yoga, and to have time to explore that so that they could then understand their own practice better. And from there, I think most see it just as that, as a deep immersion. Some will naturally have the karma that they will want to teach in a very small way. I mean, I see many people teaching once a week, maybe in a small setting, and it gives them a lot of joy and it's a good offering to the community. They're not necessarily teaching as a profession. And very few end up teaching it as a profession. I mean, we know that. And so in the end, I have many, many years to just be, you know, I tell people this very often. I often think each year, should I keep doing this? These teacher trainings? And but then at the end of each year's process, I'm always impressed with how it felt to go through that. I mean, you do this as well. It's always incredible to go through that process with people. And as I said, most of them are just in it because they want to have that process for a year. And they come out a bit shifted and inspired, and some just use it to deepen their own practice, and some maybe they're teaching a little bit here or there. But we could call it a year-long immersion. The teacher training part is a little bit the part which is sometimes I struggle with that expression, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I'm quite honest about that with people. And when they sign up, I just tell them, I'm not, you know, it's not from day one I'm teaching you how to teach. I'm going to teach you how to play the piano. And we'll spend most of the year learning how to play the piano. And at the end, I'll give you a few hot tips on how to teach playing the piano, and you'll see if that's what you want to do. And from there, the karma will show whether or not that's really what they want to do or not. So, but it has diluted things a little bit also, because it can very easily get turned out as this sort of like this product that just gets rolled out if we're not careful with it. And, but whether there are, whether there are too many teachers in the marketplace or not, I'm not sure. I sometimes wonder a little bit, because many of the teachers I know, they're doing it as a second or even third job. They really, really enjoy it. They have a class or two classes a week, and they have a group, a small group, and something really good is happening in that context, you know. And I think the competition starts to happen when people are more reliant on that job to earn an income from, and then some pressure comes with that, and there is the concurrence. There is a little bit the competition which starts to happen, and people start to doubt a little bit and push a little bit like this. And yeah, I guess that's true in many, many things in life, though. Yeah, but if that's what you mean, I think somehow that the name of the teacher training program, also this arbitrary number of 200 hours. I mean, I do struggle with that. I think there's many ways to look at training, and as you know, really the best teachers that I know and the ones who inspire me the most mostly never did a teacher training. They just were students of yoga for a long, long, long time until their teacher said, "You should teach." And that's how we used to do it. We would just invest our time and invest, and then help the teacher. And then slowly it became clear through our path that we were maybe meant to help them or assist them, and then maybe to teach or substitute them, or maybe to hold one class ourselves in that studio. And that organic process is also quite beautiful. I miss that in some ways, that we would just study this and that it would evolve naturally in that, you know.
Did you ever considering leaving the profession, like being a yoga teacher, doing something else?
Yeah, maybe just a few dark nights when I didn't sleep with the kids, you know, and then I, but no, you know, the funny thing, really, to be honest, it's somehow, that's been a lucky thing for me, that I have felt since I decided to do this, there's been no looking back. It's really, it is my life's work. It feels clear. I sometimes question how I'm offering it, and, you know, would I like to stop for a year and go into some deep studies in a certain area that I'm interested in? But it would only be to come back and continue this. And I feel it's a deep satisfaction with it. Even, you know, it's tiring sometimes, and but, you know, life is tiring sometimes, and it's right.
Every
so
profession,
yeah, every profession is tiring sometimes, sure. So I'm really clear on that. And no, I feel grateful somehow that I found it quite accidentally, and that I took the chance to let go of my original profession, which was working in photography and design. And I, in English, we say, I never looked back, and I don't have any regrets. And I only wish to keep my life balanced, that I still have enough time to be a good papa and that I can play a little bit. I like to be on my bike. I like to ride. I like to paint a little bit. I like to read. And sometimes this work that we're doing, it's a lot of work, a lot of holding space for people. And sometimes you can feel a little bit tired from that, but that's true of everything. So yeah.
And how did you get into yoga? How old were you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm old now, and I started relatively late. I was in my I was probably early 30s. Wasn't like I didn't touch it at all in my 20s. I had no idea actually at all, and it was actually a friend of mine when I was living in Vancouver who was practicing. And in that time, it was late 90s, and there was only a few things you could do. You could do Ashtanga, you could do Bikram, and there was a little bit of Shivananda. And that was it. And he was really into Bikram yoga. You go into this room and sweat like crazy and do these 26 poses in front of a mirror. And it was quite athletic and it was quite challenging. And we were all quite sporty. And we had a lot of fun, but there was something undeniable about it that seemed to touch me, not on a spiritual level in any way, that came a bit later, but I did feel quite different in my body. And I'd done a lot of different physical sports, and Something about that was quite incredible, and there was a little bit euphoric feeling of sweating like this and stretching and holding your body in these poses. And there was a community. There was a bunch of guys. We were there together, and we were having fun. And we would be so hungry afterwards, and we'd go talk about it. And one of the guys was a teacher, and it just happened like this that we became interested. And then I quickly got a bit tired of this heated room, and although I thought it was a great sequence, it was a really simple, safe sequence for everybody, and I could see, wow, it really started to shift a little bit some things in my body. But then there was down the street, there was some Ashtanga yoga with a really wonderful teacher, and I just fell in love with that, this sort of like this dynamic set sequence. And kind of once I was in that, then there was a bit of a door which opened into other aspects of the practice. And it was through my interest in Ashtanga that I ended up going to Asia to do some study, and I met my pranayama teacher, and I started to think or find out, oh, there's a philosophy behind all this. What's this all about? And I was a bit skeptic because I had grown up in a really religious house, and I was what didn't fit so well with me in my heart. And so to touch back, and I'd kind of pushed all of that idea of spirituality away. And so when I was confronted again with the sort of some philosophical spiritual tradition at the beginning, I was a bit resistant and skeptical. But it was so undogmatic and so open, and it seemed so about the metaphysics of the mind and how energy worked, and what was the cause of our suffering, rather than focus on the worship. And this was really intriguing to me. Why does the mind, why does my mind create suffering, and why do I feel a certain way? And so, yeah, I fell into it. I really, really fell deeply, deeply into it. And at some point, I remember just saying, I think I just have to walk down this path for a little while, uninterrupted. And I was lucky. I had a little bit of savings, and I was single, and I didn't have kids, so I was very independent in life, and was able to make quite a strong move to just say, I go for it. And so I've yeah, that's how it began.
And today, you already mentioned it, you are a papa, you have children, and I also have a son. How do you manage this chaotic family lifestyle, with the yogic lifestyle?
Well, yeah, I mean,
Maybe this is the reason why you became later.
yeah, maybe. I mean, why it came later, it's so interesting to see, because I've often asked why it came so late to me, but it is the way it is. I mean, life unfolds for us in ways that are a bit mysterious, and I feel grateful that it has unfolded in many ways for me, in many aspects, and including that. I was a bit not expecting so late in life that that would come, but it did, and it's really beautiful. But it's, of course, I mean, as Patabi Joyce used to say, as you worked through these increasingly difficult series in the Ashtanga system, first series and second series and third series, if you ever got there, who gets there even, But he said, yeah, seventh series, that's having kids, like if you really want to go, that's the highly advanced yoga right there. And yeah, I would say I would agree. And now I feel like I have, as you probably feel, you have a big time adjustment. I have to really adjust the amount of time I have for myself to do my own practice. And this part suffers. The time is much shorter. And the kids take a big priority, and so does the studio. We open a studio, and we love it. And it takes it's another kid. It's a lot of work, as you have this kind of projects, and I do my best to stay connected to the practice. I feel grateful for that. In the last years, I really found some teachers that inspire me, and that keeps me really bright and young in my heart, and it motivates me. And then I feel very much like in order to teach, I have to be engaged in the practice. Even if it's short, I have to be engaged in the practice. And so the biggest motivation for me to keep going is the students. And because I know my teaching, there's always a little bit of bank, like a bank of energy in your body that you can use for a while when you can't really practice, and you can teach from that bank, but it runs out quite quickly and you become quite exhausted and the teaching becomes flat. And so it's been my motivation, because I love to teach, that I have to stay engaged in the practice, but it's much shorter. And the kids are a big mirror, right? You know that. And so then I see this yoga off the mat is the most profound when I think about family life. Just, it really is like this. If yoga is a mirror being held up into my face, you know, the practices, especially the more subtle meditative practices, are like a mirror. Then kids are like a funny mirror at the circus. You know, you see yourself in ways you never thought you'd see yourself. So it's hard work, as you know, but it's been also a useful practice to try and do that, to watch myself sometimes succeed and sometimes fall flat on my face and have to get really honest with myself and pick myself back up again.
And I think since I have a son, I never experienced all these crazy feelings, like from love to being annoyed. Like, you know, you have the full spectrum when you have children. Like, and I think this is really, yeah, I think, you know, when you meditate and you travel and you practice yoga and you are by your own, and this is all very, you can control it. But when you have children, it's nothing to control, like, because there is just chaos. And then you can deal with what you have learned, or deal with your emotions, deal with,
What did
trying to be a good dad, a good mom, or not freaking out.
I think Jack Kornfield always would say, when you think you're enlightened, just go home and visit family, see how you're doing, you know. But you're right, you said it the best, really. It's like you get to test out the work a little bit in the field of family life, because it's not in your control. And in the practice, it's true, eh? In the practice, you can kind of control the environment a little bit sometimes, and you can make this false sense of security through that. I'm good. I'm peaceful. I'm calm, you know, and you're just sitting on the cushion. And so it's a very, very good practice. Also, I lately so much, especially with now with little Usha here and Henry and, you know, feeling the extra work of two at home. And Briggy talks about this a lot. And I think it's really relates a lot to how our own mind works, that the, you know, we talk a lot about in the meditative practice, not getting caught in your own identifications through the vrittis, through the mind, you know, that the suffering happens when we let ourselves get caught in the emotions and think that is what I am. And, you know, Briggy talks about it when it gets a bit chaotic, and she's like, don't, you know, don't have to crawl into the drama with Henry. You know, you don't have to crawl into the drama with him. Just step back a little bit. And this is a little bit the reflection of what's happening through the meditative process, is to not get so bound. So it's a good testing ground, but it's very hard, right? Very hard.
Next level, yes.
Yeah, next level.
So you mentioned enlightenment. Do you really, really believe in it?
Well, I really believe that people have enlightened experiences, and I'm not sure that I believe that people have what we would say is that you become enlightened and then you are enlightened. I think, you know, this is just my personal opinion after all this time. I think that there are ecstatic experiences that one can have. There are experiences that one can have which feel like a sense of oneness, where the sense of, because for me a bit, this enlightenment is a little bit similar to the Buddhist idea of emptiness. And for what they call emptiness is really when it's not separate when there's not two anymore. So when it's not separate, when there's no longer duality, then it feels empty and really free, and like one, you know, like the drop falls into the ocean. And so I believe that happens, and I believe that we, most of us, are having those experiences from time to time in life, and that it's possible to replicate those experiences through a practice. So they can happen accidentally, they can happen through nature, through love, through art, spontaneously. And then we can replicate them through the practices of yoga. And then the question is, you know, can we sustain them? And what is the effect of those experiences, those enlightened experiences, being able to be repeated or sustained? And I think the feeling I've had is that one can move close to those experiences through the practices, and then they will recede, and they will drop back down again, often very quickly. But that once you've tasted it a little bit, and once you've tasted it repeatedly, there's some part of you which is a little bit more awake and can access that place more often. Maybe just like a muscle inside of you, which is really, for most of us, it's really atrophied. That's the same word in German, atrophie. And it's just, it's not active, we're not using it, so the muscle is dead. And then you a little bit train that muscle, and it's not that it's firing all the time, but you have some access to it. And that's a bit what I see some people who have the capacity to be in that space sometimes, or and to access it, and have some tools to access it. But I always am very cautious of this idea of enlightened beings. I guess maybe there are some which are really sitting in that space that we just discussed, sustained for long periods of time. But I think that's quite rare. And I think there's a danger in this whole thing that we're doing, in searching for that as the goal, because it keeps us always in this feeling of deficit. And in many ways, I think the longer I'm in it, the more I feel like that doesn't allow us to take some ownership and joy and love and pride in dignity in the way we already are. We just are already okay as we are. Like my friend recently quoted this this beautiful idea, which is, you know, we're not, it's not a game of self-improvement what we're doing, but rather a game of self-realization. We're trying to touch back to the essence of ourselves. And when we touch that sense of our own self, this is a little bit an enlightened feeling, you know? And it's all there. It's just sitting there. It's a little bit covered. And then the quote was something like, you know, we're already absolutely perfect as we are, with just a little room for improvement, you know? Instead of being like this being which must get enlightened, you know.
I mean, this is more the tantric approach. Like, we are already there. It's already inside. Like,
yes, yeah.
There is nothing to achieve or to go. Yeah. But here comes a personal question. I have the, I can say I feel that your Kundalini is awakened, and this would be like an awakening or a part of a path towards enlightenment. Is that true? Do you want to talk about that, or?
I think that there's some the great awakening of the Kundalini, which I believe is possible within people, but is, I would say that it's, for most of us, incredibly dangerous to play with that, and that it's much, much more than most of us could ever handle. That we would have to be in such a condition of strength and clarity and support, steadiness in our minds and our nervous system to handle that. So I think that's a possible thing to awaken that energy. And I think some things in life will awaken that energy through practice, maybe not a full Kundalini awakening, if you will, but that some aspect of the prana shakti can move through this central channel of the body, or that can come to the heart or to the navel. But that it's also a little bit like a yo-yo. It can rise and touch us, and then it flows back down. It rises and touches us and flows back down. And it can cause some problems if we're not careful, because it can disturb some of the natural tendencies of our nervous system and our digestive and reproductive and sexual systems and all these types of things. It can put a little bit too much heat and power into those spaces, which can be difficult to manage. And so the arousing of the Kundalini, I think, should be done carefully. If you just really honestly, that's my honest opinion. And I think that often what's more useful for people is to stimulate just the prana shakti through the body and let it flow in a really healthy, harmonious way through the chakras, through the circulatory system, that people feel really good and healthy at their navel, their heart, their throat. They can see clearly through the Agni. The Agni is really clear, that they can digest experiences, they can digest food, they can reflect themselves, they can see themselves clearly and try to be at ease with themselves, but also evolve themselves and be kind. And that's a real gift, I think, that can flow for people through this practice. And the big Kundalini awakening is, I think, less common and more problematic. And I'm a bit surprised sometimes that it gets used so freely. And, you know, honestly, if anybody's really touched that space, that usually they're not talking about that.
But do you distinguish between the Shakti awakening and the Kundalini awakening, or is it the same in your opinion?
No, I would distinguish it for myself. But now you're asking me not from a theoretical perspective or from a school, but just my own experience, which is I think that there's a distinct difference between that. I think the Shakti can flow very in a very different way through the body, through some of these practices. And she can dance so that you feel vital and bright. And the, you know, my teacher would often say that part of what would happen through a good Kriya and Pranayama and Asana or mantra practice like this is that one would feel very naturally healthy in you know, between the lower and higher centers of the body, that you would have a good mental, behavioral, and physical health. Of course, you will deteriorate one day, but that it will feel vital and vibrant, and that the Kundalini is quite something else. That's really, certainly, in my opinion, the Kundalini opening would just knock you out completely. Yeah, you would be very difficult to function. So when people say my Kundalini was awakened, I think that's perhaps little exaggeration. But that's just my personal opinion. I think those are two different things, and the first one is very, very useful for many, many people, and very beautiful to feel that dance, to feel vital and alive and healthy like this. Even that will dance up and down. And the Kundalini, I think, it can be aroused. There's tons of examples of people forcing it, and I've been in the presence of people who forced it intentionally and unintentionally, meaning that they've done a lot of practice which have really aroused her and opened up this serpent energy. And it's extremely difficult to deal with once it's open, even for someone who's in a good, healthy shape. You know, they sometimes cannot sleep anymore. All the aponic channels, the lower channels, they get very, very disturbed. There's shaking, trembling, tremors. And so it's, I don't know how you feel, but for me,
like the spine is really hot. And
yeah, a lot of very uncomfortable feelings are taking place through that process. And we say in English, that's not for the lighthearted, you know. There should be a reason why one would do that. And
So I think it's really dangerous what is mostly I have seen it over Instagram, like what is promoted, like the activation of the Kundalini, you know, like with these pranic shocks they get. So what is it, your opinion? You would say run away when there is a workshop about the Kundalini awakening, or what do you think?
Yeah, that's hard because I know some people who do it and I like them and they're good people. And I'm not sure whether they misunderstand that word or that's what they were taught. But to me, that's the stimulation of the prana shakti. That's okay. That can feel very good. If the intention is to open the Kundalini, I'd be a bit cautious of that. I would. I think that's the wrong. It's the wrong word to use, and it's a little bit to say that one could consume that as a little course that you could do online, is a little bit of insult to what it really is. And but it seems to be a word that gets used as a keyword, and it goes all the way back to your first question, which is sort of this, you know, a lot of marketing. A lot. It's also interesting to me. I don't want to be like this grumpy old guy, but you know, why do we have to name these practices all these crazy names? Just hatha yoga, just pranayama. You know, instead it get, you know, like a 10-word description, which is full of all kinds of key buzzwords that maybe sell. And I think that part, although I'm not, yeah, I think that I can be a bit critical of that part and say that's not necessary like that. And it's also a little bit irresponsible to use those words when you're not really sure what exactly that means. I think if, you know, Robert Svoboda, who Briggy and I both follow a lot, said, you know, if you ever really touch the power of Kundalini, you definitely wouldn't use her to sell an online course, you know. So, and you wouldn't be telling anyone they can just activate Kundalini so easily. But maybe it's just the word. We should use a different word, because there's something to be said for doing the practices that will stimulate the prana shakti. But even that should be done carefully and in time. And it's the body should be ready for that. And there should be some a humble approach to that, which is done over time, so that it's also sustainable. This is also very beautiful. Let it be a slow, sustained process that changes a little bit how you feel inside, and that you can handle it.
And I believe that it's not done by really wanted to achieving it, because Shakti is also the feminine principle.
Yes.
It's a lot to do about surrender and
yes.
love and doing nothing. Like, yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, this is a very good point, which is that actually in the Shiva Shakti principle, it's, you know, we're doing practices and we are also offering ourselves to the divine and to our families and to our community. And we're giving something of ourselves to the fire. And we, through that process, like you said, of softening in this offering, we do something and we offer, then something is offered back to us through that relationship, which is useful and meaningful for us to fulfill our dharma. And this, I think, you know, sometimes I, when life is really busy and I think, wow, where am I getting this energy from? You know, where is this coming from? I should be exhausted right now. And it's just flowing. And I realize, you know, that's a little gift which is coming back for the offering that one makes. You just offer, like what you're doing, and you offer as a service, and you offer your body to the fire, if you will, and then something is returned. And sometimes it's returned in the form of this wonderful dance of the feminine energy, or this the inspiration which comes through you to your mind, the words which can come out of your mouth, the movements of your body, like that. Yeah. So I agree with you. It's usually through the surrender.
Yeah. So what are your plans for the future? Do you want to become 100 years old? Or
oh, for the kids.
Longevity.
Yeah, for the kids, I would like to stay really old and stay healthy. I was thinking about it a lot because I turned 60 this year, and it really was giving me some reflection. to
I mean, it's
think of.
very impressive. You turn 60, other people, they become retired, and you just opened your 60th
Yeah, I know.
book.
Yeah, I feel really inspired these days. It's great. I'm really grateful for that. And but I was thinking about that exact thing, and I thought, actually, it doesn't even occur to me to stop. I want to do it in a way that's not cultic, that's really sustainable. So sometimes I have to really watch the intensity. You know, like when I was younger, I could go really strong, and I like that. I like working, so I watch a little bit to be careful with that, to get enough rest. But I would like now to, I've been working on a book which is taking forever to birth. It's really, really not an easy process for me. And each year I sort of say, I'm going to really, really get it done. And I'm hoping that one of these years that will be true. But I keep putting a little bit more energy into it. And there's little things now that I can see little modifications in the way that I would like to offer the work. I've always been a big fan of this really long practices, I just like that. And I realize, through my own processes that, people are very busy and they would love something they can do in 15 minutes or 30 minutes. And I want to offer a little bit like this, that there's really useful ways that one can practice in a short period of time. That doesn't seem like a big deal, but that's something I'm really inspired to do this kind of thing. And because I do enough of these like long retreats and long practices and long days and long classes, and just keep going. I'm in a good state of studentship right now, where I'm really learning again, and I really, really feel very turned on and inspired by what's possible as a healing practice for people. I think that's why you're in this. I mean, also, it's just the world needs a bit of that, and the world is spinning so fast now. And so I just feel like just stay steady and keep offering my work. And the last year has been amazing in Bern. We opened Svarupa Lorraine, this big studio, and I kind of hoped it would feel like that it would have a really nice vibration in the walls, and that people would come into that space and feel like they could come home to a place where they felt safe to do some of this work, and that there would be different offerings in the space. And that's happening. So it's manifesting. It feels really, really good. And it's a 5-minute walk from our house, and this is also sustainable and feels nice. So nothing radically different. If you can send me some Shakti to finish my book, that's what I need. Otherwise, I'm learning a lot about life through parenting, and I'm trying to evolve through that work as well.
And what about Zurich? Will you continue to teach here?
Yeah, I think Zurich is a very, there's this concept of the Rinanabandhana, which means that there is a karmic there's a karmic debt which takes place in certain things. It's relationships between people and places, and we meet people, and it's like a two-sided coin, right? You meet a person or you meet a place, and you fall in love with it, or you fall in love with them, or there's something about that thing on the face of the coin is very, very attractive and shiny, and you're drawn to it. But of course, it has another side, and this is the part which is meant to teach you something and to learn through that process. And sometimes that's joyful, and sometimes neutral, and sometimes it's difficult. And some of those Rinanabandhanas, those binds, they last for a very long time, and some are short. We meet some people, or we're in some places, and then you can feel, okay, that's done. I've learned, or we've gone through that, this bandhana. And Zurich is a place for me which just is, there's something for me there which is really very powerful. And there's still a lot of learning there, and there's a lot of connection there, and it feels really vibrant for me. And it's a big journey from Bern. I mean, it's still, I'm from Toronto in Canada, and really, like, Bern to Zurich is actually driving just across Toronto, right? So it's all relative. But it really, from the yogic perspective and from my own karmic perspective, the time in Zurich is not finished. It's really, it feels really, really good. The past years have been really amazing to teach there. So I continue. Yeah, I
Good.
continue. A little bit, just a little bit. Yeah.
But it's a secret where.
Yeah, so far. By the time the podcast comes out, you'll know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you look back, what is the essence of your life or your yoga practice? And especially, what would you like to pass to your students? Final question.
Final question, yeah, the big one, yeah. Yeah, I think the, you know, when I was younger and then I would be teaching in these longer trainings, which you also did, and I used to always say, because there would always be these crisis points or there, you know, and I would say, just, you have to trust the process a little bit, you know, because you're going through something, you have to trust the process of this work that you're doing. Which means to be patient with it and let it unfold and to go through all of the waves of it. And that still sits very deep with me. But lately I started to think it's not all, just trust the process. I've really been thinking a lot about just what it means to me is that I've learned to be in the process, like to watch myself in a process as a human being. And the practice allows me to observe myself in a process. And that has been such a gift in a way, because lately it creates a lot of compassion and forgiveness for myself and understanding of myself and the willingness to evolve or to try to work with myself and also accept myself. And so this being in a process has been possible through doing this practice. That's been amazing, because the practice has been more or less consistent for a long time. So it just keeps showing me myself in a process, you know, whether it's just the process of the class or, you know, the whole span of a year. And what you know this, but we can only see in others what we can see in ourselves. So when I start to feel that I understand what it feels like to be in a process, then I can see that in others. I can see people are just in their process. And this creates a lot of patience and compassion for life and for people and understanding and some wisdom. And we get too caught in this this sort of yoga game, if you will, in the performance of it, and also a little bit in the deficit of it, because we keep trying to improve. So if you're trying to improve all the time, then what you're really saying is something's wrong. And this is a tricky game, you know, you have to be careful with that. And so if you rather not in that idea that there's something wrong with me that I have to improve, then you're in the process of realizing yourself and realizing people and seeing things as they are. Mm. And that feels really much more satisfying and invigorating. And maybe even that's a bit when the Shakti wakes up a little bit. She dances, because you're just in a dance, you know. And even in that, it's kind of fun to still get a little bit better at my headstand and do some cool variations in my headstand. And that's fun. I enjoy it, you know, I feel like, yeah, that wakes me up and feels, and to see someone else do it and to teach them that, that's really beautiful and really, really fun. So it's a paradox in a way, isn't it? You asked me also, like, what does Shiva Shakti mean? And in some ways it's like, the Shiva is this ability to just see that life is a process and you can watch it, and the observer becomes much more present. And on the other side, it's like life is a fun dance, and you are, you know, you're you and I'm me, and we're a little bit working with our shoulders and our knees and our, you know, our lungs, and we're, you know, and there's some relative growth that can happen in there. Can maybe grow old in a way where my spine feels healthy and bright. And, you know, we did a crazy practice earlier this week for the lungs, and it just felt amazing walking home, just lung, you know, shoulders open and lungs wide open and feeling so bright. And someone wrote and said, my shoulder hasn't felt free like that in ages. And on a relative level, that's amazing. So yeah, I don't know. That's a long answer to your question, but something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, just I'm more into yin yoga. We also do this yin yoga teacher training, and there the beauty is that it doesn't really, okay, I mean the pose needs to be aligned, but it doesn't really matter. And every pose is for every person accessible. And you hold the poses longer, and there is just a connection, like feeling myself, grounding myself, being in that state, struggling in this pose. And this, I really think, is very beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I think there is a few ways which are very useful to do asana, and that is one of them. And I think it's really great that there are good teachers and practitioners in these different methods and forms, these restorative forms, these yin forms, these alignment-based forms, these flowing forms, these dances, and that if everyone could relax a little bit and feel, okay, this is actually what I'm good at, and I can offer that. And there's a place also. Sometimes I teach this class on Tuesday, which is very, very alignment based, really setting up the bones and the body in the right way. And it has quite a bit of strength in it, and it asks a lot of you. But then I would say, I mean, that's not the way you're going to practice every day. And a yin practice, or I also teach a restorative practice on Sunday night, or a breath practice. And that it's really nice that there are these different modalities that, and that there are good teachers in those fields that can offer that. Yes.
I agree.
Yeah, good.
So thank you so much, Stephen,
Thank you also.
for
That
your
was really,
time,
yeah.
and I know your calendar is full. And tell us, where can people find you?
Yeah, you just go to www.svarupa.com and or on Instagram, Stephen.svarupa, and you can find everything there. And that's it for now. Yeah, you find everything you need on Svarupa. And it used to be 10 or 12 years ago that my website was not so updated, but now it's very, very present. It's actual. Yeah, it's really top, top, top. So, maybe you have to navigate it a little bit, but it's up to date. You find everything you need there. And I must say, I'm really impressed. I watch from a distance. I sometimes find this Instagram world a little bit too much, but it also allows me to see people that I really care about. And I watch you from a distance, and I'm really impressed with your work and your dedication and just how much amazing energy you put into it and your softness. And so thanks for having me also. I think you're doing great work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
Danke auch dir, die Hei, fürs Zuhören. Danke Mike Krümins für Gitarrenmusik. Und ich freue mich, bist du das nächste Mal wieder dabei beim Podcast Shanti Shanti.